The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast, joining you on the cusp of the start of spring training. Pitchers and catchers are reporting. As we look outside our windows here in Milwaukee, we can see, I don't know, how many feet of snow do you think are in your yard right now, Tom? I've been told 3 feet. There's more than 3 feet in my yard right now.
Well, it depends on where you want to look. JR, I have snow at the end of my driveway, and I have a 4 foot marker there and 2 inches of it showing. So,
yeah, it's ridiculous. And so obviously people are ready for baseball around here. My name is JR Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. He, of course, is Tom Hodricourt. He is the Brewers beat reporter, getting set to cover this team as they head to Arizona for what I think at this point kind of can probably safely say will be an on-time start to the, I shouldn't say safely, nothing is set in stone, but it is looking like we're headed toward a normal start here to the Major League Baseball spring training. After I chat with Tom, stick around for my conversation with Jonathan Judge. He is a writer for Baseball Prospectus. He does a lot of work with their PECOTA rankings, their preseason projections, and they actually like the Brewers quite a bit, so much so that in their preseason rankings, as it stands right now, they project the Brewers to win almost 89 games and win the National League Central. That's with the Cardinals having Arenado. That's with the Cubs still being what they are. The Brewers, you know, you might think that they have some holes left, but there's at least one ranking system out there that really, really likes them. So I chatted with Jonathan about what the rankings mean, how they're derived, what sort of track record they've had in the past, because a lot of people do look at them as pretty accurate. So I think you're really going to like that conversation. So stick around for that after this. The Brewers, Tom, we got some news on the cusp of this here early in the week here Tuesday. The Brewers announced a couple moves, a couple familiar names coming back. Brett Anderson, guy who was in the rotation last year, veteran left-hander, was signed again to a one-year deal worth $2.5 million. He's a reliable guy, a reliable arm, so that's good news for the Brewers. And Travis Shaw, a guy who was a big contributor to the 2018 team that, of course, went to the NL Championship Series, struggled in 2019. He was in the AL last year with Toronto. He is back as a non-roster invitee, and I want to start with Travis Shaw because I'm interested what you think his signing means. I mean, we know there's an opening at third base. It's unclear who's going to be the regular third baseman. There's Daniel Robertson, Luis Sirius, maybe Orlando Arcia, now we're finding out, could get some reps over there. Shaw as a non-roster guy, that tells me that that's not a huge investment on the Brewers' part, so it doesn't strike me that they're saying, oh, Travis Shaw is going to be our third baseman. But he's an intriguing option. I mean, he's a guy we know can play the spot. So how serious do you think it is having Travis Shaw in camp? How serious of a contender is he for this spot?
Well, I think he is a serious contender. I think it tells us a few things, JR. First of all, it tells us that their pursuit of Justin Turner was a special case, you know, a kind of a one-off thing. It wasn't like they had this list of free agent third basemen and he was at the top of the list. He was the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm assuming if reports of their financial offerings are close or correct, that there was some deferred money in there. I strongly suspect he used the Brewers to get a better deal with the Dodgers, which is sort of where he wanted to go anyway. Brewers can't do anything about that. They made what they considered a fair offer and what sounded like was a fair offer. But I think that was kind of like the Yasmani Grandal thing a couple of years ago, where they stretched for like easily the best catcher out there. Well, Justin Turner was easily the best third baseman out there. And, you know, I think people expected them to like move on to others on the list, like Michael Franco, or even maybe bring back Jed Jerko or whatever. But doing a non-roster deal instead with Travis Shaw tells us that they were going to spend on Justin Turner, but they're not spending otherwise at that position now. And, if readers saw the Q&A I did with Craig Hansel, my annual pre-camp Q&A, which ran in the Journal Sentinel today and is online forevermore, he interestingly enough told me that he expects both Luis Urias and Orlando Arcia to see action at both short and third base in camp. And it really sounds like they want to give Urias a good look at shortstop, which I think was the plan all along last year. Then he broke his wrist in winter ball and then got COVID and just never got out of the starting gate. So that just kind of got shelved. But, He's not a power hitter. He's more of an athletic guy. So I think he's always been in their mind their future shortstop. Where that puts Arcia, I'm not sure. He might just win the job and say, too bad, Luis Urias. I'm still the shortstop. Or he may go over and play third base. Or he may share time with Travis Shaw. The Brewers really love time-sharing positions. They do it a lot. Sometimes it works, sometimes not so much. And also, Shaw started at first base in the big leagues, too. And don't forget, they got a novice first baseman going over there in Keston Hira, who's a right-handed hitter. I know they have Vogel back. I'm still waiting for the DH to come, JR. I ain't giving up on the DH until they throw the first pitch on April 1 and there's no DH in the lineup. That's when I'll give up on it. And if there is a DH, if they do put it in at the last minute, kind of like they did last year, then there's all kinds of at-bats for Hira, Vogelback, and Shaw, so playing positions or DHing. So I think it tells us a lot. Shaw's 30 years old. It's not like he's 38. He's 30 years old. He had two great seasons for the Brewers in 2017 and 2018. I think there was some hard feelings when he left, too, because he thought they sort of gave up on him. So looks like some fences were mended. He's coming back. He'll be so comfortable. And how many times have we talked on the podcast about how left-handed power plays at now American Family Field? Hey, I didn't say Miller Park.
So well done.
Making progress. So we've talked about that a lot, right? Left-handed power. They really love left-handed power.
Yeah, 2019 remains a crazy year to me in that the Brewers were able to get to the playoffs despite the fact that Travis Shaw, who was going to be a key contributor yet again, really fell off a cliff, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, Jeremy Jeffress also went from all-star stud closer in 2018 to being released in 2019, and, Knebel was hurt, so, it's incredible to me that Brewers team was able to get back to the postseason.
But don't forget, they had really good coverage that year because all they did is move Moustakas back over to third. Remember, they were trying him at second. And then they moved him to third, and they were fine over
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Yep.
So they don't have that luxury now, And so, it's very interesting. I think Travis has a chance to be a really good fit. He's a good guy. We've chronicled his battle of his daughter's health and how much Children's Hospital in Milwaukee helped the family and everything. So I personally think it's a very good thing for both the Brewers and Shaw to try to be reunited. And it's it's no harm, no foul. If he doesn't look good in camp, he just gets cut. They're not, there's no guaranteed money to him.
Justin Turner re-signs the two-year deal with the Dodgers. We talked about how that looked like, where it was headed anyway. So it does sound like, though, that the Brewers, like you said, made a competitive offer, a comparable, if not identical offer, to try and get his services for a couple seasons. The Brewers couldn't get Manny Machado, and the Dodgers got him. They cannot find that third baseman when the Dodgers seem to be just standing in their way at all times.
They really thought, and excuse me for butting in, JR, sure. they really thought Lucas Urseg was going to be their third baseman.
Yeah.
They drafted him like 3 or 4 years ago, advanced college hitter. Hit some titanic home runs in spring training, and one that's still yet to come down in Goodyear against the Reds.
Oh, yes.
And but it just didn't happen. But I mean, they kind of went sort of all in on him as their future third baseman, and it just didn't happen. They've had real trouble at their infield corners. Here is going to be the ninth consecutive different opening day first baseman, it seems, since Prince Fielder left. So they've had trouble filling that. They've just had trouble at the infield corners finding anybody that's going to be there for any length of time. They sort of thought Shaw was going to be the guy. And after his first 2 years, he sure as heck looked like he was gonna, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of basically a steal of a trade that the Brewers got from Tyler Thornburg with the Boston Red Sox, worked out in their favor, got Mauricio Dubon, Josh Pennington as well, I believe, is in there too. So,
But Travis Shaw hit 62 home runs and drove in 182 runs in his first 2 years.
Yep.
That was looking pretty good.
Yeah, it was. And with Urseg, the Brewers, they typically draft guys up the middle. They take second baseman and shortstops. And center fielders, catchers, whatever. And then if those guys can't hack it as middle infielders, then they kind of bump out to the corners. But we haven't seen a lot of guys do that and get up to the big league level. It's first base, like you said, is another sort of I don't want to call it a black hole, but like they've had trouble staffing that spot. And so third base is a similar thing. They don't have third base prospects coming out of their ears because they're not drafting guys to be third basemen, which is.
And team, unless it's a stud guy like a Chris Bryant, teams don't draft a lot of first baseman and third baseman high up. You know what? Those, like you said, they go up the middle where the athletes are and then sort of fan them out from there. The Brewers have a ton of shortstops and center fielders in their system, young kids, a lot of them from Latin America. And eventually you can only have one center fielder and one shortstop, but you can use those guys as currency to get other things.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if the door is closed on someone like Maikel Franco. Not because I think they're going to pursue a guy like that right now, but this is the time what we've talked about where you've got a lot of unsigned quality guys out there whose price tags are about to drop because teams are about to report. And there's going to be guys still looking for a deal. I know there's going to be people. Justin Turner was one of them holding out for the best possible deal. But I got to think the Brewers are open to still bringing somebody else in if the price ends up being right.
Well, we'll see. I heard that despite the late date, Maikel Franco is still looking to break the bank. So he might have to have a rude awakening in that regard.
Right, definitely. So Brett Anderson is also back. He was a reliable starter with the Brewers in 2020. I don't know if anything in 2020 can be truly gauged or evaluated. He was okay. Strikes me as a perfect candidate to be the fifth guy in that rotation. I think to this point that spot was a little bit unclear. We could have the exact same rotation as last year. That's a marvel to me. I don't know if that's ever been done before by any team in baseball history. So I don't know if that's what you envision for him, if you see him as that last starter of the rotation, or if he's just, a guy that they're kind of taking a flyer on. $2.5 million is more than I would say just a flyer. So I see him as number five. How do you see him?
Yeah, I mean, right now there's no lefty in the rotation guaranteed. Eric Lauer, they hoping he's going to bounce back from his miserable time last year when he was hurt and had COVID, all kinds of stuff. And then Suter seems to pitch better out of the bullpen. So, right now, I feel really good that the first four were going to be Woodruff, Burns, Hauser, and Lindblom. And then now it looks like, Anderson's going to be the fifth guy. Like you said, the exact same starting rotation. But they do have, they wanted to get as many people in the mix as possible, JR, because every team's worried about the tremendous increase in innings from last year when they only played 60 games. And now everybody's going to play 162. Everybody's really concerned about that. And they're going to have to be really careful with these pitchers not to just blow them up early in the season with, ridiculous innings or pitch counts and stuff. So right now they have, I think I counted nine candidates to start. The five guys we just mentioned, then Lauer, Freddy Peralta, Brent Suter, and Jordan Zimmermann. He's a veteran. They're bringing him on a flyer as well. He's 34. He had a lot of injury plague seasons in Detroit, but like if he all of a sudden shows them he has more gas in his tank, they could keep him as like a swing man and then see if they need him, as a starter at some point. So they just wanted to make sure they had good coverage. I don't know if they'll invite any more guys in there. There's some a couple of lefties in their system. They really want to give as many opportunities as possible this spring. Ethan Small and Aaron Ashby, they're guys that were at the alternate training camp last year, and unfortunately, like all minor leaguers, had no season because of COVID, and that didn't help them in their development. But the Brewers think that they'll pitch in the big leagues this year at some point, and so got some lefties coming. Then another lefty that just has all kinds of raw potential, Antoine Kelly. He's a few years away. But all of a sudden, their pitching situation is just looking way more promising than it has for much of their past. They've had so much trouble developing starting pitchers. I did a story earlier this week on the 2011 draft and how just incredible it was, and I pegged it to Colton Wong because the Brewers just signed him, and he was in that draft too. despite all the great players that came out of that draft, the Brewers whiffed on two pitchers, Taylor Youngman and Jed
Oh,
Bradley, in the
heartbreaking.
first round. And they've just had trouble. They've had trouble developing starting pitching. Now all of a sudden, they're getting some homegrown guys in the big leagues and also coming up behind them in the minors. And teams, you see what pitching costs, what Trevor Bauer got and Gerrit Cole got, and you see what the creme de la creme gets on the market. And so you need teams like the Brewers, who have more modest financial resources, they need to develop their own pitching.
Yeah, the heartbreaking note that Jose Fernandez gets drafted between those two guys, even though it seemed pretty clear he was only going to go to the Marlins. So just one more punch on the 2011 draft for the Brewers.
But just life is so weird. That was the word that Fernandez's camp put out. Don't bother drafting us unless you're the Marlins, because he was a Florida kid. He was, a Cuban refugee, but a Florida kid who wanted to stay in Florida. And so he had a University of Miami scholarship. But suppose he wouldn't have put that word out and the Brewers drafted and he came to Milwaukee. Then he doesn't die in a boating accident in Miami, So I mean, that falls under the, woulda, coulda, shoulda, second guessing of life and death. But he was a that was a tremendous talent. They there was a just so many impact players in that draft. It just blows my mind, the guys that were picked in that 2011 draft. And like even the second, well, that year they had an extraordinary number of supplemental first round picks, because a whole bunch of free agents shifted teams that winter. And guys came out of there like Blake Snell
Yep,
and
Trevor Story.
Jackie Bradley Jr., Joe Musgrove, just all kinds of talented guys came out of the, George Springer was in that draft. Incredible draft. So Colton Wong should just feel very honored that, he was in that draft. That was one of the all-time drafts. I mean, Josh Bell was a second rounder, for God's sakes.
Oh, and the Brewers had two first rounders in the first 15 picks and hit on neither of them. Very disappointing. I want to talk a little more about Jordan Zimmermann. We haven't mentioned him. He, of course, is an Auburndale, Wisconsin native, pitched at UW Stevens Point, had a lot of success with the Washington Nationals, made an all-star team, has not been as successful since he signed a huge free agent deal with the Detroit Tigers, really hurt by injuries. My favorite fact about him is that he actually married somebody who played high school softball, my sister's varsity softball team. Shout out to Mandy Zimmerman, the fastest high school softball player I have ever seen in my life. Neither here nor there, but he's back. It's a reclamation situation. I don't think anybody expects him to contribute right away. His numbers have been really bad with injuries and everything the last couple of years. Do you think he's going to make this team out of camp? I mean, you mentioned him in the mix here as somebody that they could look at as starting depth.
Well, it just all depends on his health. He's had so much problems with his health the last few years, and he is 34 now. So, but they said, why not give him a chance? He's a, like you said, a native Wisconsinite, and he, if he was gonna try one last hurrah, he sort of wanted it to be with his home state team. I mean, what are the odds that the Brewers are gonna open camp with two pitchers in camp from UW Stevens Point?
That is crazy.
Jordan Zimmermann and J.P. Fireisen, who pitched in their bullpen last year. I mean, a Division III in-state college produces two pitchers in the same camp. That's amazing.
Yeah, and this is a we've talked about this before, but this is a renaissance moment for Wisconsin baseball with Gavin Lux and Jared Kelenic about to take over. Those are high school guys from Kenosha and Waukesha, respectively. Those guys are about to get to the big leagues and start making an impact. So the Brewers starting to get some of the residual effect too. They didn't draft either one of these guys, but sure enough, two Wisconsinites potentially on the roster. That is a rare thing. We don't get that a lot in this state.
And why shouldn't Wisconsin start producing a lot of baseball talent? I mean, look how nice it is outside. Really good baseball weather. It's been, snow up to our patooties, and minus 11-9 vortexes. Great baseball weather.
You have two dachshunds, and I feel like if they climbed to the top of your yard right now, it would be like skydiving for the rest of us. They would
They
just
got
jump
no
off.
chance. They got no chance. I mean, Admiral Byrd would have turned back. Dennis Quaid and Day After Tomorrow would have turned back.
Yeah, it's true. Check out Tom's position by position stuff coming to jsonline.com. He'll have some stories here over the next couple weeks. Pitchers, we've just been talking about pitchers, starting pitchers, relief pitchers will be posting soon at jsonline.com. So check that out. He and Todd Rosiak, of course, taking a look at all the position groups. Real quickly, one last position group I did kind of want to touch on briefly, the outfield. the starters are set. We've talked about that. It's Abascal Garcia, Lorenzo Cain, and Christian Yelich. Their depth, though, leaves a lot to be desired. Now, they did just acquire from the Toronto Blue Jays Derek Fisher in a minor deal. That's a guy that I imagine most baseball fans have not heard of. I myself did not know anything about him when the trade was announced. But he's not on a minor league deal. Like, he stands to be one of the backup outfielders. They don't have a lot of guys that you could reliably, that a lot of guys you've heard of backing up the big three in the outfield. Which leads me to wonder if the door to Ryan Braun is really closed. We've heard he's right now not pursuing anything, not pursuing playing in 2021, but that would seemingly be a possibility. Even if there's no DH, the guy could still play a little bit of outfield. I can't imagine they bring him back to be a backup, but I don't know. What do you think? That situation is settled, or do you think we're going to see some player movement in the outfield before things get going?
Well, I just think they did want to give themselves a little more coverage in the outfield. Like you said, you've got three guys that are going to play a lot as the starters. But that, Derek Fisher, the guy that you just talked about, not the three-point shooter and NBA coach. This is another Derek Fisher. This
Yes.
guy's a UVA grad, so gets bonus points for that. Really good skill set. He hasn't been able to put it together in the major leagues yet. The connection there is he was a first round draft pick in Houston in 2014 when David Stearns was still in Houston, so he knows him from that draft. And so they have in Billy McKinney and Derek Fisher, two toolsy guys who were both in Toronto last year. So because they picked Billy McKinney up, towards the end of last season, off of waivers from Toronto. So they've got a couple of ex-Blue Jays on their team. And so that I think they put, Corey Ray, another guy that wasn't helped by playing no minor league baseball last year. It was going to be a big year for him, and then they don't even have a minor league season. So they let Ben Gamble go. He signed with Cleveland. So you got Tyrone Taylor still on the team. And then they have some infielder, outfielder types. They love multi-position guys. They have Jace Peterson, Mark Mathias, new guy Pablo Reyes. So they've got some infielder, outfielder types. So I think they feel they're covered in the outfield pretty well now. They have a ton of really highly thought of outfielders in the minor leagues, but they're all young kids, a lot of them from Latin America, who also were not helped by not having a minor league season last year. So they just want to make sure they're covered at all those positions. They especially need somebody who can play center field when on the days Lorenzo Cain's not playing. So they got guys now who can do it in Fisher and Tyrone Taylor and Billy McKinney. So they tried, Abascal Garcia played a lot of center last year, but he's a big dude and that took a toll on him.
Off the field, the Brewers announced that they do have a new TV deal with Fox Sports Wisconsin. This is the twilight days of the Fox Sports Wisconsin branding. Hasn't been affiliated officially with Fox in quite some time, with parent company Fox. It's part of Sinclair Broadcasting Group. It'll be rebranded as the Bally Sports Network on April 1st. The Brewers re-upped with them for another few years. A good thing. I mean, the same announcers will be back, which is key because, the Brewers team of announcers is really, really, really good. Pretty sure Brewers fans don't know how good they have it. There's a little bit of consternation for people who want to try to watch the Brewers on streaming services. It's not available in a lot of places. It's available on cable and over DirecTV satellite, but not on Dish Network, not on YouTube TV or Hulu TV. Like, so I know there's going to be a lot of frustration, especially when the season starts. I don't really know if there was another move, though, that the Brewers would have made. It seems like they've had a good working relationship here for quite some time. Seemed like that was kind of the no-brainer decision, right?
Yeah, I don't think there was a lot of options in this small media market. So, I don't know if Sinclair can add some streaming things. I know there are some people that, want to watch the Brewers that way and are, upset about this. And so we'll see if, any adjustments are made. I don't pretend to know the TV business very well. So, but the thing that you mentioned is it was interesting that we almost got to spring training without a TV contract. It was the Brewers and the Marlins, I believe, was the only two teams that didn't have TV deals for this year. And so
I
now
didn't
it's just
even
the Marlins.
realize that. And I pay attention to this stuff fairly well. I didn't even know that the contract had expired.
Yeah, at the end of last year. COVID just kind of,
Yes.
just makes you it just. What you do and don't pay attention to gets changed on a daily basis, and in this environment. And so, Yeah, I knew it was up, and then I knew we were getting close to spring training. And so I assume any day now we'll hear a spring training TV schedule because certainly they'll want to put some games on down there. But the thing you mentioned about the talent, and last year when we did a lot of coverage on the from road games off of TV because reporters were not allowed to travel to a lot of these cities, it was driven home even more for me what I already knew that Brewers fans who do watch them on TV are so fortunate here. Since Brian Anderson has come to Milwaukee, he's become a national star. And they're lucky they still get him for as many games as they do because, all these big networks want him to do basketball, golf, every sport, baseball. He's so multi-talented and he's so good. So just to have him, who's a real presence on the national broadcasting scene is great, and he's been made such a great team with Bill Schroeder, who I covered as a player, and who's a very good analyst. Catchers make such good analysts because they had the whole game in front of them on the field when they played. And then, how many markets this size could lose a guy like Brian Anderson on occasion, and then be subbed out by either Matt LaPaya and this year Jeff Levering? Is going to come out of the radio booth and do more TV too. Bob Uecker's sidekick. So speaking of lucky, we have had Bob Uecker for 50 years in radio, and then Sophia Minnert does such a good job of in-game reporting, and all their other guys that they use on and off the field. We're just very lucky, and I think a little spoiled, JR, with the TV talent that we have in this market, and so. Hopefully, the people who do get the Brewers games on TV, and maybe they'll, Sinclair will find a way to help some of the others, realize just, how good these people are. And I think that was a big part of that announcement that, pretty much the what I call the talent, what we like to call the talent is coming back.
Yeah, and why can Jeff Levering hop over there? Because they've got Lane Grindle. I mean, who can fill
Yes.
in? I mean, the bench is so deep, like you said, to have Matt LaPay just waiting in the wings. He's like one of the
I
most
know.
familiar voices in
It's
Wisconsin sports.
crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, there are guys that do their pre and post game, guys like Craig Kishon and Jerry Augustine, Dario Melendez. I mean, and then as some of the talent pointed out to me yesterday when I gave them some kudos, they'd be nothing without their camera people and people in the truck and stuff like that. And they worked under some very strange circumstances with COVID last year. I mean, they weren't traveling either. They were calling road games off of TV feeds themselves. And believe me, that's not the same as sitting there and live and in person. So they adapted to some pretty tough situations. So it's good to see all those people coming back, We're opening the season under COVID. We closed last year under COVID. Things are definitely different. And let's just hope we can keep moving through. I'm not taking for granted, a 6-week camp not having hiccups with COVID, JR, because we got a lot of people now in one place for a long time, and so good luck. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that because I know people really want to see a full season. We something else we should mention before we put a wrap on this podcast. Looks like there's going to be more than cutouts in the stands. We know they are in spring training. And did you see what I tweeted yesterday? I pulled a quote out from Rick Schlesinger from that TV broadcast as we prepare to have fans in American Family Field. I mean, that was more than a hint. That there are, I don't know how many. What did the Bucks have? 250 last night?
They did. They're trying to work their way toward court, at least 25% capacity, long way from that. But yeah, this is trending in that direction for them to have fans by opening day for sure.
But they're going to have 25% in spring training, which means you got to assume that's what they'll do at the start of the season, too. So let's hope it's 25% really vocal people, right?
Yeah, and
Maybe.
if not even more than that, because the COVID numbers have come down in Wisconsin, and I don't know nationally. I'm not as intimately familiar, but we're making progress, and hopefully as we get toward the end of the summer, we'll have achieved a point where, these stadiums can be almost completely full. It'll be nice to oh God, it'll be so nice to get back to that point.
It's I was talking when I did my Q&A with Craig Counsell. I gave him credit. He was one of the very first people last year who started talking about how different it was going to be with no fans in the stands. And he predicted it, so a lot of players would struggle in that sterile environment. And we that's the way it played out. We saw that happen. And I think players respect the fan element more than ever now, because you can pipe in all the crowd noise you want, but it's not the same as the people actually doing it.
Players are reporting to Arizona. Spring training is about to begin. We will have full coverage for you at jsonline.com. Tom Haudricourt, he is the Brewers beat reporter, joining me as he does pretty much now on a regular basis, I would think, going forward. Not quite weekly yet, but we'll be headed in that direction. It'll be him and Todd Rosiak covering your Milwaukee Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thanks for joining us. We'll chat again very soon.
Thanks, JR.
Now I move to my conversation with Jonathan Judge of Baseball Prospectus, talking about the PECOTA rankings, the preseason projection system for Major League Baseball that projects some pretty good things for the Milwaukee Brewers, better than I think a lot of people would have expected, seeing the Brewers winning close to 89 games, winning the NL Central, you know, even the Fangraphs system, which doesn't see the Brewers winning quite as many games, also puts their percentage of winning the Central pretty high, basically neck and neck with the Cardinals. So that might catch some people off guard. I know plenty of people are going to throw up their hands and say projection systems are meaningless. They're not going to, you know, it's all what's on the field. You can't account for injuries. You can't really tell the future. And that's true. I mean, Jonathan will tell you that. They can't predict the future. That's not what they're trying to do here. They're trying to come up with a system that as closely as possible can imagine what's going to happen in 2021. They can't forecast injuries. They can't forecast, you know, certain players just having woeful underperformance for some reason. But they do tell us some things. And not only that, I think they're not just an exercise in curiosity. There's a little bit more to that that I think you'll be interested to hear what he has to say about how these sort of projection systems, how they work in baseball, you know, in baseball front offices, and how they might inform some of the decision making. So without further ado, here he is, Jonathan Judge, talking about the PECOTA projection system. My guest is Jonathan Judge. He is head of quantitative modeling. You can think of him as a writer or contributor to Baseball Prospectus. You might see his name out there quite a bit. He is someone who is intimately acquainted with PECOTA and several other modeling systems for that matter, and kind of wanted to bring him on to sort of break it down for us a little bit. Let us know how it is that some of these systems, particularly PECOTA, is telling us that the Milwaukee Brewers season is not an all is lost situation, that they actually, you know, might have a leg up in the National League Central. First of all, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. I really relish the opportunity to talk to you a little bit. But before we get into the heady stuff, give me a little bit of background about you. I know you're a Brewers fan, follow the Brewers. Give me a sense of how you got involved in data analysis and just what it is about Brewers baseball. Like what brought you to this place in the first place?
It's an interesting story, I guess. I, like most people, I followed the Brewers when I was, at least when I was a kid, kind of lost interest a little bit in the teens and early adulthood. And then in 2008, when I noticed that the Brewers seemed to be making an active effort to succeed, I was sort of drawn back in.
That is one way to put it. I love how you put that. Yeah. Basically, when they stopped sucking, I was back, baby.
That's right. That's what a true fan does. So so I started paying attention again, and then started following a bit more regularly. And then it's all kind of strange, frankly. I just started wondering more and more about how things work and how these statistics work and basically just kind of how the world works. And so I ended up learning more and more about statistics and learning more and more about baseball. And then the two just kind of have kept reinforcing each other ever since, the point where I now know a lot about statistics, not even baseball statistics. And so that gives us a lot of tools to sort of look at questions that interest us. And it's just kind of become my primary hobby outside from, you know, gainful employment.
There are two systems that I associate with you. One is DRA, deserved run average, which we'll talk about very briefly. It's sort of a new way of looking at evaluating pitchers. It's a kind of a better metric than ERA. And like I said, we will talk about that. But what interests me today is a system known as Player Empirical Comparison and Optimization Test Algorithm. So much easier to just say PECOTA for those who remember Bill PECOTA, middle infielder of the Kansas City Royals from, at least from my childhood, I guess that would be the early to mid 90s. So I know the name isn't important. What's important is what it says, projecting how players and teams are going to do during the course, you know, evaluating what they've done in the past, taking a look and trying to imagine what they're going to do in the future. I think we all came away from a point in this offseason where the St. Louis Cardinals had Nolan Arenado. They had traded for him, and everybody kind of threw up their hands and said, okay, that's it. The Cardinals are now the favorite, the one team in the NL Central that's made a big move. They've got a difference maker at third base. The Cardinals are the team to beat in the NL Central. But not so fast. Pecota will tell you, as we look at least right now at the preseason projections, the Brewers are, at least in the current model, favored to get about 88-plus wins, as close to 89 wins, actually. So that, I think, caught everybody off guard. So I guess, and we can go into some of the methodology and everything, but, like, first off, how is it possible that this Brewers team that we're all panicking about could be good enough to win 89 games? How is that humanly possible?
It's primarily possible because of the pitching. The pitching, which is something that Pecota has particularly good at forecasting in recent years, is just incredibly strong. We see it as the second strongest. I think when I checked, it's like the second strongest group in the entire National League. And so maybe the thing that for sort of listeners to put it into perspective is, you know, if last year the pitching was so good for the Brewers that if the offense would have been merely average, I think they would have just walked away with the division and even had it wrapped up early. So in a sense, that sort of created a very frustrating environment for everybody. But on the other hand, it kind of shows you how close they really were, because if you're really good at the hitting or the pitching, you really only have to be average at the other one, and you will still be a very good sort of playoff team. And so since we're sort of seeing them as highly likely to retain that very strong pitching thing, the only question is the hitting going to bounce back a reasonable amount? And frankly, that's the thing that we do expect, because it was just such a bizarre anomaly of very small, you know, short samples, very different environment. We look at how these people have historically hit, the Yeliches, the even the Omar Narvaez's and Avi Garcia's, and we just say, look, these people are not bad hitters. They're just not. And if we look at sort of the track record rather than just saying, oh my God, look what happened last year, you tend to get a much more broad perspective of the player. And so what we're trying to do is to say, basically looking at sort of the types of players that these folks have been, and you know, particularly focusing on the skills that are actual skills rather than more random things. You know, how strong do we think they'll be? And we do think the offense can be basically average-ish, and we think the pitching is going to be really good. And somewhat to their benefit, the other teams in the division all have major problems in one or more of those same areas. Sure. And so it's not like they're in the NL West playing the Dodgers and the Padres. They would probably get plowed and be down to a 500 record, but they don't have to play those teams very often. They get to play the other NL Central teams who all have some pretty serious flaws in at least one or both, or in the case of the Pirates, all areas. And then, you know, because you get to play those teams, you have a leg up on those teams in over 162 games. We just think that they're going to probably most likely, you know, be better than the rest.
You kind of touched on evaluating 2020. I mean, I think a Brewers fan could say realistically, Christian Yelich, Keston Hira, and the rest are not going to hit as badly as they did over a 60-game stretch in 2020. You could just as easily say that Corbin Burns isn't going to be a Cy Young caliber pitcher over the course of a full season, or what to make of Devin Williams, things like that. So I guess it kind of works both ways. Is there a way to sort of, in a layman's terms, note how Pecota evaluates 2020? Is it any different than any of the other data you've gathered, or is 2020 given less weight because it was such an unusual environment, unusual year? How did that process work?
Yeah, so we actually wrote an article about this on our website on baseballperspectives.com if people want to read it, where we talked about sort of introducing Pecota for the year. We talked about 2020. So the answer is no, it doesn't really make a huge difference, because what we do is we sort of just try to model and take account for sort of how all baseball players sort of tend to trend over time, and how, you know, your performance last year versus 2 years before tends to sort of affect the next year. And since we already have a wide variety of samples from players, we have, you know, people who played 20 games, people who played 60 games, people who played 80 games, on balance, we just sort of treat them like we would anyone else. And as a practical matter, I think that 2020 gets downweighted a little bit just because 60 games of 2020 is probably not going to be as information filled as 162 games from 2019. But there's nothing really particularly magical about it, I think, in that respect. And it's important, I think, that we not pay too much attention to it that way. Because as human beings, we tend to overreact to things. That's our flaw. There's a lot of sort of methodological research that says that it doesn't really matter how good your sort of model or formula is. It does, but an awful lot of your success simply comes from having a formula in the first place that you apply consistently to everybody. And so as long as we have a formula that works well and we've tested it and it works really well on average, we're reasonably confident that, we can sort of account for that to the extent that we can.
And so we talk about Pacoda now pretty much every year. So clearly it's working or we wouldn't be, you know, clearly there's some success there. Are you able to quantify that for those who will just say, whatever, projections, they're meaningless, they never pan out. Is there a way to sort of illustrate how successful Pacoda has been in engaging? And maybe another question or a better way to ask that would be, are there particular times where everyone said before the season it'll never happen, like that Pacoda's crazy, and then sure enough, end of the year came along and look, the Pacoda projections were pretty close?
Sure. So there are a couple of ways to look at it. I mean, there are always one way I would start is by saying we look at how accurate we are on average. And there are comparisons that are done after the year in which they basically say, look, how close did the various projection systems come. And I think like 4 out of the last 5 years, we have been the top ranked one. So we consistently, I mean, you're going to be wrong to some extent because it's baseball and because it's the highest variance sport out of all of them. It's more random than football, more random than hockey, certainly more random than basketball. And it's a little all over the place, but we tend on average to do better than others. I would say that in terms of the team standings, it's really important to realize that there is a margin of error. That's a concept that I think people are somewhat familiar with from political polling, which is a bit controversial at the moment, but
you know, people are probably sick of margin of error, quite honestly.
They really are. But I mean, it is important here because what we do is we simulate sort of the seasonal matchups like thousands of times. And so depending on, you know, what order those go in, you're going to get slightly different things. We usually look at our records and we say these are like plus or minus 6 wins. So it isn't so much that we're sitting here saying you're definitely going to win or you're definitely going to be fourth place. But what we're really trying to do more of is sort people into bins. You know, there are the bad teams. There are the super good teams. There's the above average teams and the below average teams. And then there's the sort of mushy middle, which tends to be a pretty large group. And so understanding where you are, at least among those buckets, is a great way to understand whether it makes sense to sort of spend more money, add a free agent, to trade some more people. Because if you're like a 78 win team, going out and spending $10 million on some guy that'll give you 3 or 4 more wins, all for the very great privilege of getting to 500, is kind of a tough sell. I mean, fans would love it, but to the owner and to the GM, they're sitting there saying, why would I do that? On the other hand, if I'm a 85, 86, 87 win team, you know, that's, you can sit there and say, well, if I would add 2 or 3 more wins to that, that could actually make a real difference. I have a much better chance of getting to the playoffs and getting all that money. So that's kind of what projections are for and why we use them and why every single team uses them also. In terms of sort of conspicuous examples, by definition, we have to disrespect a number of teams every year. And that is actually great because people claim they're outraged, but in fact, they love it. It's content because you get to then write about the what the projections are. Then you get to write about the outrage about them. Then you get 100%. To ask the team members about them.
You are speaking my love language, Jonathan.
Yes,
I love it.
So this is tremendous content, as a certain person would say, for everyone, no matter how good they are. In terms of sort of famous projections, I think in 2 years ago, was it? We had this, yeah, it was 2019. we projected the Cubs to be only like a 500 or even slightly below 500 team. It was a scandal. People were, you know, this is obviously another 95 win team. This team is destined for greatness. It's a dynasty. And then they ended up winning, I think, like 84 games. And so it was a little higher than what we said, but, you know, we were being trashed by Cubs management to the media over it in Chicago. Ooh. It was really a very sticky situation. And they insisted that they were going to win 90 or 91 games or something. And so I don't think anyone quite knew how to resolve that who's right aspect, but we have had a number of examples of where we just said, you know, like the Royals, we never liked them very much during their heyday. I wasn't really involved then, so I take no responsibility for that. But, we always are going to undershoot some teams and overshoot some teams, but we are not afraid to take risks, is how I would put it. And so because we're willing to take risks, sometimes we can be spectacularly right or wrong. But on average, I think we do a pretty good job.
What is if there is a blind spot or just empirically where you've seen Pecota misfire? I mean, obviously guys get hurt, guys woefully underperform that no one can predict, has no bearing on, or, you know, there was no evidence that it was going to happen. You mentioned free agent or midseason acquisitions that ramp things up a little bit. Are there cases in the past where it's been one or two things you could point to besides these obvious things that maybe prevent Pecota from being a little more accurate?
Yeah, because we can't really account for the future. And that's really kind of a big deal. What we're kind of telling you is this is where everyone is on paper, to use an expression I think that resonates with people. If we were to walk out tomorrow and everyone was ready to play, and we just kind of played, this is sort of on average how we think it would turn out. But, you know, things change. People do get injured. We can't account for that. It could be that teams just kind of have a bad string of luck and they react to that. So teams that start losing a lot of games will sell off a lot of their players. Teams that are suddenly winning a bunch of games, and it could just be kind of good luck, you know, early on may decide to start buying teams. That's going to cause those two records to go in completely different directions. That's why we kind of say when we say plus or minus six games, and then that really kind of means, in theory, like it could be 12 on either side, depending on how crazy it gets. We really have a certain limited ability to really forecast the future. And if we could truly anticipate all of these things, we certainly wouldn't be publishing and telling everyone about it. but, you know, we really do, what we're really interested in is sort of how, what bucket are these teams going in? What's sort of the range of outcomes? If you look at our website, I think this part of it is free. You can actually look at our standings, and below it, we have these humps, which show sort of all the distributions of outcomes. And they will show you the Brewers in one of our simulations winning as few as like 70 games, and in others winning almost up to 100. It's just, it's the average, you know, the most common, you know, concentration of outcomes is in this mid to high 80s range. So that's how we kind of end up with that.
Sure. I think one of the misconceptions people may have is that, especially as they're speaking derisively of analytics and as a concept, is, oh, you punch a bunch of numbers in a computer and that's it. You let the computer tell you what's right, what's wrong, that it's very absolute. But my understanding is this isn't, it's not like that at all. And that there is a lot of discussion, a lot of just eye test comparison, a lot of, you know, changing weights here and there to make sure that everything is as accurate as it possibly can be. Can you just kind of briefly touch on the process? Once you have that first batch of whatever computer readout, I feel like it's not done for you guys. There's a little bit more tweaking that goes into it. How does the process work?
No, it's very involved, and contrary to certain people's opinions, it is actually being stared at by a lot of people who actually watch a lot of baseball games.
No doubt. So
there's really two parts to it. One is that what we are trying to do is sort of come up with formulas that work. And these are basically based on going back to old seasons. So we might say, okay, if we go back and sort of look at the 2019 season and we look at all the previous performances before that season, we'll say, okay, what is the most accurate prediction for like the strikeout rate and the walk rate and the home run rate? And once you know all those things, you can kind of put them together and come up with your composite, you know, ERA or OPS or whatever you have. But we test it so that it is as accurate as possible going through back years. And then we say, okay, let's reset it for this year. And let's sort of use a lot of the same inputs updated for another year. And that's how we tend to get fairly accurate results. But yeah, I mean, the first draft comes out And then it is, you know, the Wolves are ready, and they go after us pretty hard internally. Harry Pavlidis, who sort of heads up all of our sort of research efforts, is fond of saying that like the BP peer review process is by far worse than anything you will get on social media or anywhere else. It is just, we really push each other hard. And I have been sent back more than a few times saying, this is not right. Go and double check it. You've been down on this guy 3 years in a row. Something is wrong. We're missing something. Go take a look. It's a very rigorous internal process, because there's so much we can't predict, but if there's anything that we can, we really want to try to find it.
Baseball Prospectus has Pacoda. FanGraphs, another popular statistics website, has Zips. Their projections are still, I think, bullish on the Brewers a little bit. They have them just, I think last I checked, just a eyelash behind St. Louis for first place in the division, seeing their chances of getting the playoffs, at 35%, which isn't bad. I mean, 89 wins would be better, better odds than that. But 84, 85 wins, that's decent. What are the fundamental differences, if it's easy to explain, between what Pacoda does and what Zips does? Why would we see a wide variance between the win totals? Is it just fewer simulations, or how would you describe that?
No, it's just, it is what formulas you settle on. There are lots of different ways to sort of weight things. There are people who, for example, will use nothing but a player's individual previous seasons and say, I'm just going to average all this. Whereas we tend to take the opposite approach and say, let's look at everyone's seasons over time and then sort of use that to show, a trend that, and then we expect this player will be part of that overall trend. So there are lots of different ways to come up with roughly accurate, reasonable things that may come up with, 84 wins, 89 wins, 80 wins. Where you start becoming worried is when someone shows up and says, no, they're a 75 win team, or no, they're a 98 win team. And everyone kind of looks, and how did you get that? And if you look at the comparisons where they do look at how Pacoda does compared to these other systems, they're not all that far off. It's not like one of them is, every once in a while someone has like a crazy year, but all of them are sort of in the ballpark. And if you kind of look at the general hierarchy of teams, they tend to be pretty similar. So again, that sort of plus or minus six wins, if you do that, that could actually cause 4 out of 5 teams in the NL Central with the right combination of, randomness to sort of tip up to the top. It may not happen very often, but it's just one of those natural things in which different people can disagree. And there are certain people who actually have a practice of taking multiple systems and averaging them all together and claiming that that actually provides the best results because everyone is a little bit better at something. And sure, that gives you the best chance to get a sense of what's going on.
4 out of 5 teams in the Central, the poor Pirates, they're way on the outside looking in. If you mentioned those humps at baseballprospectus.com/standings. If you want to look at them, Milwaukee, Chicago, St. Louis, Cincinnati, they're all, in the same ballpark. And then there's Pittsburgh, poor Pittsburgh. I'm sure one of the things you hear all the time, and what anyone who subscribes to any remotely scientific theory hears is, oh, numbers, they don't matter. These projections don't matter. It only matters what's on the field. Okay, fine. We can all agree that that it's not going to play out exactly as projected. But what I'm gathering, and you would probably know this better than me, is pretty much every front office has their team of people doing this same type of work. And they might be using their own formula. They might be just using Pacoda or Zips or whatever, averaging them. I don't know. But teams are doing this too. The revolution ended a long time ago, and every front office is looking at this stuff. And I wonder how much it impacts their decision-making. Obviously every team is always looking to get better, but you look at a Brewers team, we'll tell you they're strapped for cash, and it's one of the reasons why they didn't add a ton of people in the offseason. But on the other hand, if they think they're an 89-win team because, their model shows that they're within that, in a really good position to fight for a playoff spot, it doesn't make sense to give a 2-year deal to a 38-year or 36-year-old third baseman like Justin Turner and take that financial risk, because you might have this team already. You might just need to tweak around the edges. I don't know. Can you speculate? Do you know how much these projection systems are popular in baseball? I got to think that a lot of the people you work with have been connected to teams, worked with teams that have some sense of just how big of a deal this is within the industry.
Yeah. And I've certainly, I mean, I've worked for, you know, multiple teams sort of on and off over the years, and it absolutely, this is critical. This is, in fact, I will be more emphatic about it. Projection is the only thing they care about. Nobody cares. Wow. Nobody cares in a baseball, in a competent baseball front office, about how you did last year. People have already been promoted and fired off those results. The only thing that they care about is the future. So they are doing this, all of them, their own ways. Some of them rely in part on stuff that we do, I think. They at least they pay attention to it. They almost all have their own systems. They have people who sit around all day and whose sole job is to think about stuff like this. And so they have their own systems like this. Their own systems are giving them an expectation about, you know, how good of a team they have, how volatile their team is. And they use that to decide whether it makes sense to spend more money in the offseason, maybe wait and see how the season's going and check in midseason. Those are all things that they absolutely take into account. And it basically infuses virtually every decision they make. So, you know, saying that the only thing that matters is out on the field, I mean, I think that's sort of an, as like most of these statements that people like to make, it's sort of like both obviously true and a little bit unfair.
Right.
Obviously, the only way you win is by having people who can hit, people who can pitch, and people who can field. But the question is how you find those people and how you decide when it makes sense to go get some more of those people, as if, you know, they're not exactly on the shelf at the supermarket either. They're a rare quantity and you have to really make some decisions. So no, it's just, this is literally what every team is doing. And it is, with the possible exception of developing players, the number one thing that they care about. So this dictates everything. This is what they care about.
I'll shift back to the Brewers a little bit, since I imagine that's what most people are interested in, and most people are delighted to see Pecota project the Brewers to be at or near the top of the NL Central. Maybe this is an opportunity where I can give you to talk a little bit more about DRA, but since the Brewer pitching is so central to their success, maybe because you know obviously you invented that statistic, you can give us a little more background on what that tells us about Brewers pitching. But I mean, we're hoping that Brandon Woodruff is an ace. We're hoping that, you know, they've got four guys at least who are capable rotation guys. Maybe Adrian Hauser takes the next step to add things. Corbin Burns continues on the same path he's on now. You know, Josh Lindblom. Give me just some perceptions you have of this Brewers team, particularly the rotation, but just in general. I mean, I know for me, seeing them at the top of the Pecota standings gives me an added level of excitement I didn't have before, because I wasn't thinking this Brewers team was going to be all that special, having seen what they did in 2020. But now I'm thinking, they're not nearly as bad as I think. And I know, like you said, it starts with that pitching staff.
It really does. The thing with the pitching is, it's hard to enjoy pitching when your offense is not scoring runs, because it's just very frustrating. Because then the games all feel that much more in reach, and yet you struck out again. And it is sort of infuriating as a fan. And I think that tends to infuse a lot of our sort of perspectives from last year. But, you know, the Brewers pitchers, they strike a ton of guys out. And when they don't strike a ton of guys out, a lot of those balls are going on the ground. And that is a defining feature of their pitching staff. And so there's a reason why they wanted Colton Wong in that middle. And that is not just because of the, you know, the defensive upgrade, which it is from Keston here in that position, and he can take some of the good range that he has and move it over to first. But it is, they put a lot of balls on the ground, and they need those. They need a Hoover system around that infield to get those balls and turn them into outs, because otherwise those innings will get out of control in a hurry. And they need that to happen. And so, you know, if you're giving up ground balls, you're not giving up home runs. That's good. And if you're striking the ball out, if you're striking batters out, excuse me, then you can't put the ball in play at all. And since those are two skills that are really repeatable, you don't strike a bunch of guys out and then forget how to do it. And you don't generate a bunch of ground balls and suddenly forget how to do that. They're just fundamental aspects of pitching. And so once you do it, we expect you to keep doing it. And when you have those two things, you have a pitching staff that, particularly given their sort of unorthodox approach and their willingness to mix and match people and do strange things that they think will work, and they're usually right, they just have a tremendous margin of error on the hitting side in terms of what they really need to kind of get where they want to go. Do they want to have more runs? Of course they do. But that really is the strength of the team. And it's people were talking about this, the Milwaukee's Tailgate podcast and other things, of how difficult it is to envision a Brewers team that is good at pitching. It's a very odd feeling.
Totally.
We used to outscore teams. We did not do this pitching thing. But that's really what they are. And that's sort of their identity as a team. That's just an area where they've excelled. And so, you know, if that gives them just a huge leg up on the rest of this, and they don't need a whole lot else to go right to be a contender and to really be, you know, either for the division or to be into the wild card right at the end. I think that one thing we haven't talked about is what's wrong with some of the other teams in the division.
Yeah.
And I can talk about that a little bit, because I think that that's part of it. Again, they're not in the NL West. They're not in the AL East. They're in the NL Central. And that is a nice place to be if you are a somewhat flawed but highly capable team.
So I guess we don't need to talk about each team, but why not the Cardinals? I mean, we just talked about, they've got Arenado. They've got Paul Goldschmidt. They've got Molina behind the plate, who might be, you know, not as good offensively, but still solid defensively. What's missing from St. Louis? Is their pitching staff that much worse than Milwaukee's?
Yeah, actually, it's fine. The problem with the Cardinals is that they're fine. We project them to be about 500. I think Fangraphs projects them to be about 500. And it's because their offense is average. They have those names you've heard of over the first four lineup spots. And as the saying goes, and then what happened? And from spots 5 through 8, not so much. And they have a couple names that we've seen forever in the rotation. They have a couple relievers that we've seen forever, but there's just, you know, it's just average on balance is how we sort of see it. And so, you know, whereas the Brewers are sort of have by far the best pitching in the division and, you know, have sort of a middle of the road offense. The Cardinals are seen as having sort of a middle of the road offense, actually even somewhat below average offense. And then their pitching is decent, but not as good as the Brewers. And St. Louis and Busch Stadium is actually the hardest, might be the most pitcher friendly park in baseball, believe it or not. So it's just hard to score runs there, period. And if you're playing there for half your games each year and the ball just dies, which is what happens in Busch Stadium, it's hard to score runs. You have to do extra. And at this point, we really don't see them as most likely being able to do that.
And before I let you go, any optimism that this Brewers offense, or what should be our signs of optimism that it will improve? I mean, you mentioned that Narvaez and Avisaíl García, they're not those bad of hitters. They have a track record. I think the worst case scenario we would imagine is if Christian Yelich's drop off is real, and that 2021 is, you know, he's better, but not markedly so than he was in 2020, and that nobody else sort of picks up the slack around him. And you mentioned they have a little margin for error on the hitting side, so it's not as important. They don't all have to become 300 hitters and, you know, pound 35 home runs out or anything, but is there any indication to you that this offense will be better in 2021?
We think so, and I think it's the sort of defining aspect of the Brewers, and it's really sort of something that I know they've striven for sort of in the David Stearns era, is not so much trying to find great hitters at every position, but to avoid black holes.
Sure.
That has been the problem for the Brewers in the past, is that they had, it's been too much of a stars and scrubs sort of operation. You have a couple really good hitters and then like two or three positions, it's just brutal. You just give back. You can have Yelich in one position, but if you have, you know, very below average hitters at two positions, you're going to give back a lot of that and you're right back to square one. And when we look at their lineup, what we find interesting about it is that we just don't see black holes. If we see, you know, Urias at third and, you know, Arcia at short and Wong at second and now here at first and then Yelich and Kane and Garcia, these are all people who we kind of see as being sort of average-ish and not people who are playing a position because someone got injured or because they were all that was available or because, you know, it's their turn or something like that. They're all people who we see as being average-ish. Now, they won't all be average-ish at the end of the day. Some will actually be a little, you know, notably below and some notably above.
But unless it's 2020, in which case everybody is notably below and you just have to pray that doesn't happen again.
Right, and that probably includes the two people on this podcast.
Exactly, 100%.
It's a rough year for everyone. But no, we don't see them as having holes, and so that makes their floor higher. And I think as long as they can keep the floor in place, you know, the ceiling on their hitting is a little bit less important.
He is Jonathan Judge. You can find some of his writing, a lot of his writing at baseballprospectus.com. Like he mentioned, the standings are free to look at if you want to check it out. There are some explanations as to what goes into Pecota, and it's fascinating stuff. And anytime you could tell me there's an analytics system that has the local team at the top of the standings, that certainly should pique people's interest. So give him a follow, check it out. Jonathan, I'm so happy to do this. This was really cool. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast here.
You bet. Could I just say one thing to maybe be inserted at one place? Just
absolutely.
About subscription? That would be great. So we also, you know, a lot of our content is free, like the standings and some of the other things. But a lot of our sort of special analysis and our projections of individual players, we do, that is under a subscription program. That's pretty reasonable. But if you go to our website at Baseball Prospectus, you will, you know, you can kind of see a lot of our past statistics in some of our articles. And then you can also, if you really want to know how a particular player is projected versus some other player, that's a good place to do that.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining me. Hopefully we'll cross paths again soon. We'll do this again next year when you know, why not?
That's great to be. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.